Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks. We are live today from New York. We have a number of guests joining us live from all around the world today, and we are going to get into it right now. So up in the news, first of all, the big news, of course, in the fintech world is that the UK fintech lender Wonga, famous for their entry into the payday lending market a few years ago, raised a lot of cash, seem to be going very, very well, has entered administration. And so this is sort of really the big first big fintech. I guess they're a unicorn, I don't know, but that hit that. So that's big in the news. But before we get to the rest of the news, let me introduce our first guest who is joining us, Spiros Megaris. I hope I got that right, Spiros.
Spiros Megaris. You can call me one.
Okay. So Spiros is, of course, one of the global fintech influencers, part of the fintech community on a global basis. You can see him very active on social media in respect to fintech. He also runs his own advisory firm. He advises a number of startups in the space. And so, Spiros, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Brad, for having me. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, it is. So Spiros, just in respect to where are you calling in from, joining us today?
Actually, I'm calling from Switzerland, where I'm based.
You're in Switzerland.
Yes, I'm based in Switzerland.
Okay, it's 9 o'clock at night there, is it, or 10?
No, it's 9 o'clock.
Nine o'clock. Okay, very good. So you're based in which part of Switzerland?
German part, very close to Zurich. It's called St. Gallen.
Okay. I know St. Gallen. Yeah, yeah. There's a very good finance university there, right?
Yes, indeed, a very renowned university. Yes,
exactly. Yeah, I did many years ago visited the university. But so welcome on the show. So Spiros, what caught your eye this week in terms of news? Anything of particular interest that you've been watching the last week or so?
The one thing that surprised me was Warren Buffett's investment in India's Paytm,
which finally getting into fintech, right?
Yes, and I mean more institutions will get into it, but it shows to me that more and more established players realize the space. You know, it's not only us insiders, and you know, we have a lot of followers which are also very much interested in this space, but it seems like people realize fintech is here to stay.
Absolutely. Well, if Warren Buffett's investing, then, you know, it took him a while to get into tech as well. So I guess the writing is on the wall. So in other news, before we start talking about sort of the global fintech environment, Spiros, we have Standard Chartered has appointed their new CEO for the new Hong Kong virtual bank that they're launching. So they, under the new HKMA rules, there are virtual banking licenses. You can be obviously a fintech startup and apply for that, or a traditional bank. Standard Chartered has applied, and Dennis Gouven, who was he's been around at Standard Chartered for a while, but previously he worked at BBVA at Garanti Bank in Turkey, and he was responsible for their digital assets program there, and as well as was involved in the launch of iGaranti, which is the digital platform they launched there. We have got a bit of cyber activity with the regular. Both the Australian regulator, the Reserve Bank of Australia, and the Bank of Spain this week have both apparently been victims of cyber attacks with distributed denial of service attacks and so forth. The Reserve Bank in Australia said nothing to see here, doesn't affect any of the domestic payments or pension or welfare programs in Australia, so relax. But interesting to see, these attacks happening on central banks. UBS is closing their smart wealth robo-advisor division, selling their tech off to Sigfig. And Sigfig have and UBS have, of course, previously announced entered into a partnership in 2016 where UBS invested in them to create sort of a joint advisory technology research and innovation lab. And so the UBS's advisors are powered or augmented by the Sigfig technology developed there. Also, of course, some blockchain stuff is happening. A big bond, public bond issue was done on the blockchain this week. Was announced the first fintech is live on Swift's cross-border payment scheme using blockchain tech as well. That's a UK-based Ubery. Starting to get some interesting, more mature action happening in the markets at the moment. The other news, of course, in general tech news, you'll notice that on September the 12th, if you haven't heard already, Apple is having their next big event at their shiny new spaceship headquarters in Cupertino in San Francisco. And September the 12th, this is their official show. They have two, obviously, for the year. They have the Worldwide Developer Conference. That's normally not hardware. It's mainly focused on software. But September is when we get to see a bit of hardware development. So we do expect to see a new iPhone. There are supposedly three new iPhones in the work. An upgraded version of the iPhone X is included in that. And there's a new Apple Watch going to be released and a new iPad Pro, reportedly, according to the rumors. The big news, of course, is that there's a lot of development being put into camera lenses to support their long-term augmented reality objectives. With the 3D sense technology that Apple deploys and the camera image recognition, this will be used so that your phone, when it's in a room, can map your surroundings, get an internal map of your environment, and place onto that 3D environment augmented reality digital objects. So that's part of their strategy towards that. Of course, Apple is also investing billions of dollars in smart glasses, but don't expect to see them anytime soon. Even though Magic Leap has announced their developer kit, it seems like 2020 is probably going to be the year where we first start to see commercial versions of augmented reality glasses coming into the market. With our second guest on the show today, Byron Rees, he's going to be talking about The Fourth Age, his new book. I'm sure we'll get into a little bit of how augmented reality will be introduced into society and what impact that will have. But for now, don't forget our upcoming conferences. That it is conference season. October, November are very huge for this stuff. So we have, of course, Finovate Fall in New York. So that's going to be in September. I'm just checking the dates for that right now. September 24th to 26th. And, of course, the big event that I'll be there at Finovate Fall in New York with both J.P. Nichols and Jim Marus. And don't forget also Cybos at 2018 in Sydney, and that's between the 22nd and 25th of October. So make sure you get along to both of those or check those out. We'd love to have you there at Inner Tribe for the Future of Money session, and I'll be doing a keynote and book signing down at Cybos as well. That's at the International Convention Center in Sydney. Of course, at the same time, running as a competitor to Cybos will be Money 2020 in Vegas, and a lot of the usual suspects from the fintech crowd will be out there in Vegas, no doubt. Spiros, what are your plans for October? Are you going to be attending any of these big events over the next few weeks?
Actually not, because
you're too busy doing actual work.
Kind of. No, I mean, basically those advisory roles of those startups which I'm invested in occupy most of my time now. So I don't do many speaking engagements now, but, you can't do it all.
Fair enough. So listen, you've been watching the fintech scene now for a few years. Obviously, you came in as a fairly early voice in the process. We met for the first time, of course, at Innovate Finance in London.
Yes.
A few years ago now, but obviously we're both in the community now. As it starts to mature, as people like Warren Buffett have started to take a look at this. Obviously, one of the questions on practitioners' minds, if they're looking at this space, creating their own startup and so forth, for some of them, they may have an option of choosing the market where they wanted to be based. And this really comes down to now we see certain fintech markets starting to develop regulations that are very friendly for fintech innovation, and others who are lagging behind. And it doesn't necessarily a correlation between global financial centers who are necessarily fintech leaders either. So, in your travels and in the work you've done over the last few years, the advisory work you're doing, give us your thoughts in terms of, say, the top three cities or locations where it's a healthy environment for fintechs to be operating these days.
I mean, obviously, it's China, India, I would say China and Hong Kong as one place, I consider it one. And then, of course, the US and UK. I think those are the fourth, I would call them those four hubs that I think are still very interesting. I mean, obviously, China leads. You can see that with those fintech startups, they have them. And they're not even startups anymore. They're like monsters.
Of course. Wow, yeah. If you look at, of course, the biggest privately owned company in the world these days is Ant Financial out of China. So,
So sometimes when we talk about fintech startups and people ask me where to invest or where the potential is, I always exclude China because China is an animal for itself. I mean they're very innovative, they're very aggressive, they work, I think, harder than we do, and it's just people are much more open to fintech solutions.
I work pretty hard, dude. Speak for yourself.
I know we do. I think we all do. Otherwise, we would not be successful.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
America has advantage that we know that they have the tech giants.
Yes.
And the tech giants, I think without tech giants, America would not be in a good place. Because tech giants recognize the financial space as something as an important space. You know, it's an important part of our lives. I mean, we pay our bills, we have our mortgages. So if you want to connect with the people even closer, you have to get your feet into that space. You know, it's not like it's the most profitable thing to do, but I think it's very important for the tech giants that realize that to get somehow some financial services on their platform to make people even more willing to go to Facebook, to use all those messengers, for instance.
Obviously, you've got the tech giants in the US. They've really paved the way for large scale venture capital investment, haven't they?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they're all in that space. Look at SoftBank. I mean, money's around. It just I think investors are just more selective. You know, maybe 4 years ago you were fintech and there were people just giving them money, but now people look at traction. So money is, I think there's plenty of money. It's much more focused on fewer startups.
Yeah. So, obviously this year is a bumper year, record year for fintech investment. Already for the first half of this year, global investment in fintech had exceeded last year's record investment in fintech. We had a show on that a couple of weeks ago. We, of course, had Amar from Medici, Let's Talk Payments, our partner for distribution out of India and elsewhere. Is part of the problem in terms of innovation access to capital, do you think? Because you have Singapore that, from a regulatory perspective, seems to be doing some phenomenal things in terms of sandboxing and so forth, right up there with London. But London has all of these challenger banks, and Hong Kong are similar to Singapore, but we haven't seen the sheer volume or number of startups emerging in this market. Is that a function of the fact that they're smaller cities, or is it a function of venture capital access? What do you think?
I think it's a function of smaller cities. I mean, look at Switzerland. You need enough population in order to get this traction. And the bigger the cities are, the bigger the countries are, like China, India, America, the more likely you will find successful startups that that succeed. And it's just, why? Look at the different game. Let's not look at fintech or insurtech or AI. Just look at soccer teams or any sports. I mean, the more people play it, the more likely you will have top teams, that support it, and you have more talents. And I think it's a number game at the end. But yeah, it doesn't mean you're not going to find a star somewhere in a small village, a startup. But it's more likely you will find it in a big country.
So, you obviously advise a number of startups in the space. What do you look for as an investor to choose someone that, A, you'll advise, and B, that you'll actually invest in yourself?
Basically, the standard things, team, team, the solution, but that's just general. I mean, it's very hard to sense if the timing is right. Is it something that it's people are asking for it now? Would I ask for it? And can I explain it to somebody very simple? Because if I have to start thinking very hard to understand what they're doing, they're not going to have much traction. Maybe I missed the boat, but if I understand it very quickly, and if somebody else simply understands it, then probably there's a market. And then you have to do the footwork. You have to do the research. But I think understanding the business and being at the right time and right spot, that's the key. But that's easier said than done.
So tell me a bit more about your background before you got into the fintech space.
Yes, my background is in the hedge fund business. So basically, and I had my two startups in New York. I had my two failures there, big billboards. So I know how that feels. And basically, I look at companies as an analyst, and not from a profit sense, but will they grow? Do they have the right people, etc.? And what's the burn rate? I mean, at the end of the day, I think people who have can manage their burn rate, they're more likely to succeed. Because if all your competition dies off, at the end, investors will look at people who are standing.
And maybe you should talk to Tesla, dude.
Yeah, but that's a whole different animal.
It is true. But it's sort of fashionable these days, isn't it, to have a big burn and just raise more money, without having the revenue to sort of really get to break even. I mean, even if you look at Twitter for their first years, you look at Amazon for their first years, for a decade, right? They weren't really worried about break even or profitability. They were just worried about growth, right?
But, I don't think Amazon could do it again if they would start now. It's just another way. I mean, they executed beautifully, but that investors were so patient with a company that didn't have any profits. And at the end, it was worth it to be patient. But I think people are not as patient anymore in the fintech space. And if I look at some challenger banks, I love the idea of challenger banks, but I think most of them want to be bought because the burn rate is so high. I mean, to grow the business is very tough. I mean, but what's cool
I could talk about that.
But what's cool about them is, if you work with some incumbents, it's magic because they're innovative, they're agile. And if they do a partnership, then it's magic, I think. But, if they have enough money, why not? It takes a while to establish a brand that people trust. Because at the end of the day, with trust, if you put your salary in your account, that's the first step. And if you put your savings into a challenger bank, that's a bigger step.
So obviously, Tencent with WeBank and Ant Financial with their Yuebao and other initiatives that they've built in China, these guys obviously have built trust. So what is it about these two massive fintechs in China that has enabled them to build trust that even from a research perspective, they're even trusted more than traditional financial institutions? What do you think that the reason behind that is? And of course, the question is, could challengers in the UK or US replicate it, right?
Yeah, if they have time enough, they will be able to replicate, or Facebook, or one of them, tech giants. But, China, look, in Europe, the Western world, we had a banking system. We're very used to this. So it's very hard to compete against that, In China, everything was new. It's like, okay, there are some banks, we're communists, we're not communists anymore, we're some banks, and then there are some tech giants. And as much as, the more you use those big names, the more trust you build, And people interact in China quite a bit with Alipay, WeChat. And so it's for them, it's going to be the same thing with us. Eventually, we don't care what we bank. I don't care. It's really only a question of trust. And that if they survive long enough, those challenger banks in Europe and everywhere else, they will be real competitors.
Mm. I've got a theory behind this, which I explored, of course, in the new book, Bank 4.0. But I've got a theory that the reason we trust banks today is that you go to the ATM machine or you go to the point of sale, you stick your card in, and it works. You get your money out, or the transaction takes place. If that technology was failed frequently, right? It didn't work. Let's say one in four times, the ATM said, "I'm sorry, we're down." It gave you a 404 error on the ATM screen. The point of sale didn't work. "Sorry, it's declined," and you got cash in the bank. And if that was happening, frequently, then would the fact that a bank has a bank branch or has a bank charter still enable you to trust them? My view is no. I think that trust could be lost if you don't provide the utility with which the bank is predicated on. Which brings me to Ant Financial and Tencent. If you think about how they grew up and they were created, they emerged by building payment services for the red packets over Chinese New Year. And we're talking about 700 million people exchanging these Chinese New Year red packets at massive volumes, and it worked. It worked flawlessly. So I think if people learn that, hey, this platform works, and at much bigger volumes than the banks can handle, I think that trust equals utility in that scenario. And maybe that's the technology is where that's taking us,
Yeah, good point. I think it's only a question of time, because trust you have to build, but it's a question of time that it's going to happen. Look at Amazon. When Amazon started, we're old enough with books. I remember, if you would have told somebody that you're going to do so many other business over Amazon, they would have said, we're on radio show. You're crazy.
But I don't even think Jeff Bezos necessarily thought that he was going to be in all of these businesses. Maybe. But if you read the early interviews from Bezos, it was all about the name of the bookstore, Amazon. Was all about books, right?
But that only shows you, if you go back in history, that things that we don't even think they're crazy. I think it's natural. In 5 years, you will see more challenger banks used by many people. And I think banks, of course, they're very comfortable position now valuation-wise because they have the assets. But, in 5 to 10 years, it's not going to happen overnight. Things will change. And, people wouldn't care if they were, if the bank with JP Morgan, Goldman Sachs, or with Facebook. At the end, it's just, if they provide you some great service, like your firm does, Moving. And it's just at the end, it's just a beautiful package you provide. And at the end of the day, it's convenience. You know, in real estate, right. as we know, it's really, it's location, location, location. In our space, it's convenience, convenience, convenience. The less we make people think and make their life work, the more successful we're going to be. So basically, there's not going to be one solution. It's going to be get moving. It's going to be a lot of packages. And through AI, machine learning,
it'll be bundled together through the AI.
Spiros, you're going to use this, and you're going to get your check, right? It's like Spotify. Your song has been played that often. Your app has been used that often. And I couldn't care less because it serves me. And that's the future. And it's a big task. So that's a thing. Look in China, one thing I really want to say quick. People have the choice between WeChat or Alipay. You know, it's easy, just one. But most Chinese people, they only use one because it's too inconvenient to use another.
It's network effect, right? Their friends or the businesses they use that one platform. That's probably how they learn about it in the initial instance, right?
They stick with it.
Yeah. All right. So listen, we've got a couple of minutes before the break, about 3 minutes before the break, Spiros. But I hope you can stick around because I'd like you to join the conversation with Byron after the break. But before we go to the break, who would you say we should be watching apart from the Tencents and Ant Financial? Who are the startups out there that you're really interested in that you think in 5 years time or 10 years time, you know, these are going to be big parts of the future ecosystem?
I know one company I'm involved in is WeFox. It's an insurtech company that basically is about to close a big round. And I think that they're doing a fantastic job because they figured out how the insurance business can be improved. And but I'm involved, I'm biased, and I love what they do. Basically, they have a B2B and a B2C service, and it all interacts, and it serves the incumbents. But there are a lot of solutions out there. It would be unfair, but what would be your answer to this, Brett?
My answer to this? Well, you know, I think if you look at sort of the disruption, I think where we're going in 5 years, the big differentiation will be advice. And so AI is core, and it's the people who have all the right data. And so one of the reasons, you have the big shifts occurring in China is that the day-to-day payments behavior has shifted to these non-bank platforms, and that is the big problem for the incumbents in those markets. So I'd look where the data goes, who's got broad aggregation platforms. But the other element is just as you say, who is developing this new benchmark or baseline for low friction engagement? In InsurTech, I like GenLife out of Hong Kong. My mate Steve Monahan runs that down there. In the blockchain stuff, there's a couple of really interesting stuff. I like the Sun Exchange, which does solar on the blockchain. In terms of AI, well, that's a bigger conversation. But
you can see, there's so many good companies out there. So therefore, it's a question of time until this financial industry will be shaken by its core.
Absolutely. Well, listen, let's just take a quick break, Spiros, and then we'll come back. We've got an author, best-selling author, going to talk about his new book, which is The Fourth Age, the subtitle of which Smart Robots, Conscious Computers, and the Future of Humanity. We'll be back after this break, and we'll be talking with Byron Reese from GigaOm.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit facebook.com/Voice America.
Have you become a member yet? Sign up now to become a member of Voice America. It's always free and easy. Plus, you get to take advantage of some great member benefits. Get unlimited access to millions of hours of on-demand content across all of our channels. Keep track of your favorite episodes, shows, and hosts in your own customizable library. Find out what shows you might be interested in based on your favorites. Plus, you get insider access with our newsletter. Membership gives you more. sign up at voiceamerica.com and click register at the top right.
Think you've seen everything there is to see in online television? Let us surprise you. Visit voiceamerica.tv today for sports, health, business, and more on demand 24/7.
Now, before we get back to talking about fintech, I want to take a quick moment to tell you about eFinancialCareers.com, one of the supporters of the show. They're the world's leading career site for financial service professionals for over 15 years. eFinancialCareers.com partners with leading financial and fintech firms, so your resume is seen by all the top companies and recruiters in the US and abroad. Now, as we all know, financial services is a very dynamic, ever-changing industry, and eFinancial Careers provides valuable resources from helpful career coaching to interview strategies and tools that keep you up to speed and well-informed with what's happening now in the industry and what it means for your career. Registration's free for financial professionals. Make sure you take advantage of all the resources they have to offer. So check them out, eFinancialCareers.com.
You're listening to Breaking Banks featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
We are back with Breaking Banks. My thanks to the team at Finovate, who is our strategic partner. We are media partners of the Finovate team. Look out, of course, for their Finovate Fall happening in New York just next month in September. But it's now time to introduce Byron Reese. Now, Byron is an entrepreneur, a futurist, a technologist. He has 25 years as a tech entrepreneur. He's got multiple IPOs under his belt. He's had a couple of exits along the way, and he recently wrote a book called The Fourth Age: Smart Robots, Conscious Computers, and the Future of Humanity. It's done extraordinarily well. So, Byron Reese, welcome to Breaking Banks.
Thank you for having me.
So tell me a little bit about your history, first of all, to level set. You talk about the fact you're a tech entrepreneur, but what sort of technology stuff have you been involved in?
Well, when I left university in 91, I kind of looked around the world and said, that's the great thing of our age. And so I moved to the Bay Area and joined a startup. And it's relatively arcane things, but I've been in the media business before, and I did a bunch of video. I've been all over. I mean, because like you were alluding in your earlier segment, there's so much going on. There's so many things you can do that I have a hard time like sticking to one.
Yep. So you, of course, now are the CEO of GigaOM. It's a media company. Tell me, for those that aren't familiar with GigaOM, what do you guys do?
We're a technology research company. And so if you're in an enterprise and you read about all of these technologies and you need to try to understand, like, how do we move forward and take advantage of all that the world has to offer enterprises, this overwhelming amount of possibility, we try to organize it and make sense of it.
And where are you guys based? Out in the Bay Area?
We're actually in Austin, Texas.
You're in Austin. Well, that's sort of a cool destination for tech these days, isn't it?
You know, it has a high level of energy.
So what makes Austin good as a tech hub?
You know, I think it is because the word diversity is used a lot, but if you think about it, Austin has a major university, and it's the seat of government, and it has a music scene, and it has a movie industry, and then you have Dell and TI, and then there's the energy sector, and on and on and on. And so what happens is it's a place that really is at a crossroads of so many things.
Now, Your latest book, The Fourth Age, it's done very well. It's currently doing very well in robotics, artificial intelligence on Amazon, has some great reviews. But in respect to this, we often talk about, in terms of innovation, you hear bandied around terms like the fourth industrial revolution and so forth, but you define the ages of humanity shaped by technology a little differently. You talk about four times in history where technology has reshaped humanity. What are the first three of those?
The first was when we got language 100,000 years ago, and that's our singular ability as a species. And then 10,000 years ago, we got agriculture. And the reason that was such a big deal is that gave us the city, and the city gave us the division of labor, and that created prosperity. And then the third one was actually a convergence of two technologies, writing and the wheel, which coincidentally happened at the same time, but together were the necessary components of nation states. So immediately after those two technologies came on the scene, you had all over the world in Mesoamerica, Mesopotamia, the Po, Indus, you had these great civilizations emerge because you could promulgate laws and you could collect taxes and all the rest.
Right. So the Sumerians and so forth, right, with the Hammurabi text and so forth, right? Yeah. So tell me then about the fourth age. Obviously, artificial intelligence. You call that conscious computers. Obviously as a branch of AI. Obviously, we've got machine learning and so forth now, which doesn't necessarily have consciousness. But how do you think this is going to change the world on a global basis? And at a time when we've got pushback against globalization and all of these sorts of things, it would seem like the potential for AI, based on what we've seen the internet already do, that the potential is to really change the way humanity connects on a global basis.
I got into this because I was very confused why the narratives around AI varied so much. Why does Elon Musk is afraid of it, and Stephen Hawking said it could be our last invention, and Bill Gates said he was worried about it. And then you would hear these other people like Zuckerberg and actually a lot of practitioners who said that that was all kind of ridiculous. And I really wanted to write a book that was, why do they disagree? Like, what do they know or believe that makes them different from each other? So I actually wrote a book that doesn't actually tell you what I think. I mean, I don't hide it, but it's not that important. What I try to do is take apart, you know, this narrative about automation. Either it's going to take all the jobs, or we're going to have this huge shortage of humans. And I really wanted to understand why there was so many competing narratives that were so radically different, all by presumably, you know, intelligent, informed people. And what I came to understand is that it isn't that those people know different things, it's that they believe different things about the nature of humanity and so forth. And so I wrote a book that explores kind of all the possibilities that could happen. And the first question I ask the reader is, what are you? And the choices I give you are you a machine? Are you completely mechanistic? Or are you an animal, which is kind of a machine that has life or something? Or are you a human, which is somehow an animal with something else? And so depending on your answer to that first question, that explains 80% of the differences in people's views on these questions. So I really wrote a philosophy book disguised as a technology book.
Are you a philosopher? Is that how?
Well, I think you can't deal with technologies like this that are like, can a machine think? Like, think about that question. Can a machine think? I mean, we don't really have an answer to that, mainly because we don't have a language around. We've never had to worry about anything thinking other than an animal. So can a machine think? Can a machine understand anything? Can a machine feel anything? Or can it only sense things? And that's where consciousness comes in. Consciousness is, you know, you experience the world. You feel temperature, whereas a computer measures temperature, but you feel warmth. So could a computer ever become conscious? Well, that's both a philosophical question as well as a technical question. And so I kind of go through eight different theories on where consciousness comes from. In a few of them, machines could, and a few of them, machines couldn't. And again, I try to set it up for the reader where I ask them some questions that allow them to kind of take their own beliefs through it. I didn't want to just be another guy with an opinion telling right. people they should think like I think. I wanted to really kind of explore the range of the debate, understand all the assumptions behind it, and then discuss the implications. That being said, kind of no matter what happens, artificial intelligence is, I think, going to put us into this thing as big as speech or language. And one of the most telling clues about that is that if 25 years ago the Mosaic browser came out, and if somebody had said, hey, in 25 years, there are going to be billions of people on this thing, what do you think is going to happen? You know, you would have said, well, the Yellow Pages are going to have problems. You would have said stockbrokers and travel agents. And you would have been right. But what you would never have gotten was Google, eBay, Etsy, Amazon, Airbnb, all of that, $25 trillion in wealth.
Drones delivering packages.
Everything. Yes. And it's all simply one technology, which is make computers talk to each other. That's all the internet is. It's just allowing computers to talk to each other. So if you let them talk to each other and you get a million new companies and $25 trillion in wealth, what's going to happen if they all start thinking, what if they effectively make everybody on the planet smarter? What if tomorrow we woke up and everybody was essentially 20 IQ points smarter because you had these digital assistants? Mm. That's profound. That's, you know, that's game changing.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm very interested in the concept of quantum consciousness and the fact that the brain or consciousness may be a quantum effect. But of course, we don't really know how human consciousness works as yet. So the real question is, why were we assuming that machines will think in the same way as humans?
Well, that's a very, very fair point. I mean, when I start talking about consciousness, which again is your experience of the world, you have to start asking, you know, which animals are conscious? And then you have to, then it's reasonable to ask, are plants conscious? And the reason that's interesting is you share 50% of your DNA with a tree.
Right.
And you wouldn't know if that tree was conscious or not. So how would you know, to your point, if a computer is conscious or not? Mm. I mean, because you don't share any DNA with that
thing. Yeah, that's true.
And so, yeah. And even if one day it said it was, what would you believe?
How could we verify it? Yeah.
I think in the end, it would be very reasonable to be highly skeptical. However, I think you have to err on the side of caution. If the machine ever said it felt pain, you don't want to be, you know, that species that just ignores it and says, nah, no, it doesn't.
Now, I do note, and Aspiros, I don't know if you saw this, but on Byron's homepage, ByronReese.com, he's got a really useful little app here, a quiz, which is, will a robot take your job? And now, you know, Spiros, are you concerned about the impact of AI on employment?
Actually, very much so. And though I think, I hear everything from the Industrial Revolution, people got new jobs, but I think people who will lose their jobs, they will not have the skills to jump on what it takes to be part of this AI revolution. So it's going to be a painful situation for many people. And I think that's, I'm a big believer that more people will lose jobs than jobs will be created.
I take a different view of that. So there are two things really there that you're talking about. I don't believe there's a notion of there aren't going to be enough jobs created. There is an infinite number of jobs. So, you know, in the United States, over the last 250 years, unemployment has always been between 5 and 10%, except the Depression, which wasn't caused by technology. 5 and 10%. You get electricity, 5 to 10%.
It was caused by bankers. We'll get the Industrial Revolution,
5 to 10%, and so forth. And so you have to say, what happens? And I think there's a fallacy in that view that, so here's what the narrative says. Automation's great at creating these new high-end jobs like a geneticist, but it destroys these low-skill jobs like order taker at a fast food place. And then the setup goes like this. Do you really think that order taker is going to become a geneticist? And the answer is, well, no. A college biology professor becomes a geneticist, then a high school biology professor gets the college job, then the substitute teacher gets hired on at the school, all the way down. The question isn't, can those people that are displaced do these new jobs? The question is, can everybody do a job a little harder than the job they have today? And if the answer is yes, which I believe, that's 250 years of history. Technology has always created good new jobs, destroyed bad jobs. Everybody shifted up. And that's why we've maintained full employment all throughout all the technological disruptions and have rising wages along the way. I think the half-life of a job is about 40 years, maybe 45. I think about every 40 or 45 years, half the jobs vanish. And it's been doing that for 200 years. And we never have bumps in unemployment because of it. Because what people do is 100% of the cases, you take the new technology, you figure out how to use it to increase your own productivity, and you've just created a new job.
I mean, that's beautiful said. I mean, it makes a lot of sense when I listen to you. And but nevertheless, I mean, look at all these people who are unemployed. Why don't they get jobs? And I mean, and those numbers, 5 to 10%, they're only the numbers until you get paid unemployment checks. Once you're off the system, you're off the grid.
Oh, there is another element of this, which is a systemic thing, but which your data flies in the face of, Byron. But if you look at the macro changes at industry level, industrial revolution comes along. People move out of agriculture and farming; they move into factories. Right, in the 60s and 70s, with the drive of automation of factories, people move out of factory jobs into white collar and blue collar service industry. And now AI is going to attack human process in service industry. What sector do they move into?
Well, that's akin, in my way of seeing things, like asking, okay, the internet 25 years ago is going to get rid of the stockbrokers and the yellow page people and the travel agents. What are they going to do? And the thing is we can't see it. We would have never said, oh, they're going to sell crafts on Etsy, or they're going to, the millions and millions of jobs that just you could not have ever even imagined that came out of just connecting computers together. In a way, AI doesn't replace people in the way people think it does. Anybody with a tool that has AI in it becomes effectively a person as smart as that tool. If they can use that tool, their productivity just went up. They don't have to understand how the tool works. They don't have to code it. But if you can give them a tool that has smarts in it, then all of a sudden that is empowering people. That doesn't leave people behind. You mentioned that job test, you know, will a robot take your job? And it asks 10 questions, you know,
What did you get on the test?
I find precious few jobs that technology can completely replace. Very right. Few. If it requires mobility, like my plumber, a robot's not going to be able to do it. If it requires empathy, a robot's not going to be. I mean, it's very hard to come up.
Not in the current state. Yeah.
Right.
But in 20 years.
Well, that is an interesting question. So, there's two distinctly different kinds of AI. There's what we know how to do now, which is teach a machine to do one thing: play chess, spot spam email. And then there's this thing that people imagine may be possible:
task-based machine intelligence.
Correct.
Machine learning. Yep.
Some people believe we're going to create a general intelligence, and AI is smart and versatile as a human being. Now, when you hear people say you should be afraid of it, that's what they're talking about. And it's a technology that we don't know how to build. I think that's very clear. Estimates on when we'll build it range between 5 and 500 years, which is kind of telling as well. Many people believe that it is impossible. If you don't believe you're a machine, that's the whole rationale. You are a machine. Your brain is a machine. Everything about
you is a biological machine.
Okay. Therefore, we can build one someday. That's the beginning and the end of the logic. If you believe that, then yeah, we're probably going to build one. It always seems to be 25 years out, though, and it seems to have been 25 years out for a long time. It's a sufficiently far out distance for a futurist to know, have nobody remember that they said that.
Yeah, well, you know the definition of a futurist, don't you, Byron?
I don't know that one.
It's means never being wrong today.
Good one.
Yeah. Spiros, you had a question or statement?
I wanted to ask, do you believe that we will have a period, a painful period of this transition from losing jobs to finding new jobs?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I mean, I think every advance in these technologies just creates opportunity. When you think about it, all technology does is magnifies human ability. You can move more bricks with a forklift than on your back. Every piece of technology you build that can magnify human productivity will increase wages and will create jobs. The question, and I think the truck driver one, that's this kind of one that people cite, is kind of the least concerning of everything. In fact, truck drivers are facing kind of a demographic disaster. They're aging rapidly, and because everybody's like, there's no future in it, very few people are going into it. And so we're actually going to have this great shortage of truck drivers as far as the eye can see. Even when have self-driving trucks, you still have to have people involved in all of that. There's a fallacy called the lump of labor fallacy, that there's a finite number of jobs, and if a bunch vanish, then you have unemployment. Well, this isn't true. Jobs can be made up out of thin air the minute you take something, add technology to it, and make something worth more. That's a job. And however much value you added in an hour, that's a wage. And so the reason unemployment never went between out of 5 to 10% is not because, oh, we didn't make, big inventions in the past. I mean, the assembly line was artificial intelligence, a frightening kind of artificial intelligence, right? It could take an unskilled worker and they could make a better product cheaper. That's AI. And that didn't cause systemic unemployment. So no.
In fact, it's argued that it created the middle class in the United States, particularly the Model T, Ford, and so forth, right?
Absolutely. And so we're facing something bigger than that, because we're empowering machines. See, all AI is a really simple idea. Take a bunch of data about the past, study it, look for patterns, make projections about the future. That's all it is. It's nothing mysterious or anything like that. It turns out, though, computers are so good at doing it, they give people essentially great new abilities.
There's a purity of it, right? So, hey, listen, we've got about 4 minutes to close. So I just want to, sort of wrap this up, and I want to say a few words about the book in closing. But, the overall assessment from, those that have reviewed the book and the feedback on the book and my view of it as well is that you're quite optimistic about the future. So what do you think in, 30 seconds, 60 seconds, what are the most optimistic things that we have to look forward to as a result of artificial intelligence?
Technology continues to get better and better. And something that I think comes out of that is that we will eventually solve all technical problems, purely technical problems. Now, there are a lot of problems that aren't purely technical. I mean, there are bad people, right? But there are things that there's no reason they exist. We just haven't figured out how to stop them. So I believe you'll see the end of disease.
Like diseases, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Poverty, yeah. I believe, is a technical problem. You don't have to have poor countries. Hunger is a technical problem. There's no reason you have to have hungry people in the world, and all of the rest. And I think that we've had 10,000 years of progress, and to think somehow now that we get these great new abilities, it's going to vanish is just wrong.
No, I don't think we're going to go backwards, but there's another element to this. You talk about the fourth age, but in the two first ages, people didn't work like we work. They didn't do a 40-hour, or if you're Elon Musk, 120-hour working week. Most people spent most of their time just looking for food. So work is a fairly relatively new phenomenon. But so maybe AI will enable us not to have to work in the same way that we do. That'd be positive.
Keynes, 100 years ago, wrote an essay that said, if economic growth continues, and it did, people in the future will only have to work 15 hours. And if you do the math, that's kind of true. If you want to live like people lived in 1930, no air conditioning, 600 square feet, no medical insurance, no vacation, and all of that,
you could
probably
work
do
15
it.
Hours. Yeah.
Exactly. But what happened?
But if you want an iPhone every year,
exactly. We decided we would rather work.
Hey, listen, so we're going to run out of time here, Byron, but before we do, I know where can we get your book? Where can we find out more about it so that people can...
thank you. It's available, you know, as they say, where fine books are sold. It's called The Fourth Age, and you can just go to my website, byronreese.com, and read snippets and the rest.
Right, that's byronreese.com. So, and of course, it's on Amazon. It's on Barnes & Noble, and as Byron said, wherever good books are sold. So thank you for joining us today, Byron, and we'll definitely watch with interest how it develops.
Well, thank you for having me.
No problem.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
And Spiros, yes? just quickly, what do you got coming up in the next couple of weeks? Just like 20 seconds.
I will have a cool startup coming up, investment in September.
Well, great. Let us know. I know it's too early now for you to let it out. But where can people follow you? What's the best place to?
Best place to follow me is on Twitter. Spiros Megaris. It's the handle. That's
one question I have for you. How do you do 160 tweets a week?
Basically, fintech is my life, so it's 7 days a week. That's about it.
Right. Well, listen, it's great to have you on the show. And we welcome having you back on the show at some point in the future. All the best out there in Switzerland and of course, Byron in Austin today. That's Breaking Banks for this week. We will be back again next week, of course, with next week is Tom Blomfield from Monzo going to tell us about what's happening there. Of course, rumors that they will be soon the next unicorn in the space. So stay tuned for our interview of Tom from the CEO of Monzo next week on Breaking Banks. See you then.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time for more of the latest in fintech news.